The Gateless Gate, Case 1. A monk asked Joshu, "Does a dog have Buddha nature?" Joshu replied, "No." At a time when so much in our lives has become turned upside down, become dysregulated, where our usual routines and structures are cut out from under us, we need to go back and ask ourselves, what is most important? What is most essential to us in our life and in our practice? What's most fundamental in our practice? What is the thing that we need to keep coming back to over and over again in order to give ourselves the kind of orientation that has been taken away from us by recent events? So I thought I'd go back to case one of the Mulankan, traditionally considered the foundational koan of Zen practice. So we just go back to basics and ask, what is it that this koan is meant to convey to us? What is the most fundamental thing we need to realize and practice with? See, the koan is framed in terms of a seemingly unbridgeable dichotomy or dualism between a dog and an ordinary or even debased creature and Buddha nature. Something seemingly transcendent, perfect, almost otherworldly. And the monk asks, can these two things be brought together? Can this split be healed? And Joshu's answer, "Mu." On the surface, or literally, says no. But that no undercuts the question itself, denies that there's any split at all from the very beginning, that there's any gap to be bridged or any wound to be healed. So the question the monk asks plugs right into the most basic divisions that define the suffering of our life. Have or have not, better or worse, sickness and health, life and death, deluded and enlightened. We inevitably, quite naturally, map our life out on a grid of these dimensions. A grid of how am I doing? How am I feeling? How is it going? Am I there yet? And it's not as if those questions or that dimension is ever going to go away or is intrinsically invalid. There's nothing wrong with preferring to be healthy instead of sick, to protect yourself from the virus rather than to get it, to hope that your loved ones stay well instead of get sick and die. Obviously, we're not talking about eliminating those kinds of distinctions in some fundamental part of our life or how we choose to live and value things. Yet our Zen practice is grounded in the experience that there's another dimension, another perspective on our experience that doesn't divide it that way. And Mu is the embodiment of that other perspective. What is Mu? Over and over, you can go into Dokusan, and the teacher can simply ask that question of you over and over. What is Mu? What is Mu? And any answer can be rejected, any definition, any example. Uman, in his comment on the koan, says that to really penetrate Mu, we must raise great doubt. Capital G, capital D, right? And sometimes students would be puzzled by this and sort of say they don't know what it means to try to raise great doubt. Where is that supposed to come from? And the answer is that great doubt is what you already bring to your life in your practice. Great doubt is the inner split that everybody feels at some level about not being good enough, about not being whole, being damaged, being lacking. It's the doubt of, am I okay the way I am? And the answer inevitably being, no, I'm not. Not quite. It's not how I should be. It's a fundamental doubt that as we are whole, or good enough, or lovable. Everyone carries some version of that doubt within them. What we can say practice is asking us to do is to make that implicit assumption of lack explicit. And in the traditional form of koan practice, you could say that doubt, that sense of I'm lacking something, I'm wrong, is projected into the process of trying to answer the koan. The koan promises, if you can get the right answer, then you'll walk with Buddha and the patriarchs, right? If you can get the answer, finally, you'll be okay, right? You'll have gotten it. And so the form of the question, the form of its presentation in Dokusan manifests or expresses that basic inner sense of split or lack, that there's something we're missing, an answer we don't have, something we've got to get that's finally going to fill in the hole, bridge the gap. I've got to get the answer. What is Mu? And I think it should be obvious, as long as you feel like there's an answer you don't have and that you have to get, you're perpetuating the problem. And even if you think you've got the answer, you're perpetuating the problem. You're still framing things in terms of questions and answers, deficits and antidotes, having and not having. So we sit, and we sit over and over again, just sitting, perhaps with Mu, perhaps just repeating to ourselves, Mu. What is it? What is it? This week, believe on May 8th, will mark the 90th birthday of the poet Gary Snyder. And a friend sent me a little quote from Snyder, which he responded to someone who asked him, how did all those years of Zen training affect you as a poet? This is what he said. Changing the filter, wiping noses, going to meetings, picking up around the house, washing dishes, checking the dipstick. Don't let yourself think these are distracting you from your more important, serious pursuits. So you see how in all these things, Snyder is giving you the answer to Mu. When we begin practice, we might have a lot of fantasies about the enlightened state. We may hear things about oneness, with a capital O, of course. And we think of oneness as a kind of magical experience in which we will feel one with everything, one with the world, one with nature, one with every other human being. And it's all quite glorious and quite abstract. And there are, in fact, times when we might be swept away by having feelings like that for the moment, in which we feel one with nature. But Snyder is describing a whole other kind of oneness, and one that I think is really the real way in which practice transforms our daily life. See, the oneness that he describes is the oneness of equal value, right? It's like somebody says, what's it worth to go to a meeting? One. What's it worth to check the oil? One. What is it worth to wipe your kids' noses? One. You know, the same thing, the same value is attached to everything that you encounter and everything you do in the day. It's a totally horizontal view of life, right? One of the most basic dichotomies we live with, of course, is what's valuable and what's not valuable, what's important and what isn't important. And what he's describing, what happens in Mu, is that whole hierarchy collapses. Everything that was arranged in a vertical column is turned over and is now on a horizontal line. Everything is just one experience, one moment, one right after another. I do this, I do that. I think this, I think that. You will remember the old candy bar commercial that said, sometimes I feel like a nut, sometimes I don't. That's a good expression of Philip Bromberg's theory of self-states, right? A completely horizontal view of the mind. Sometimes I feel this, sometimes I feel that. And there's no hierarchical arrangement into this one's healthy, that's sick. I've got to try to be more like this. I've got to get rid of all that. It's just one state after another, right? Lined up horizontally, not vertically. Mu is a very tricky and even dangerous kind of practice. Because if you make it the focus of concentration, do nothing but sit with that move, you might, in fact, have some remarkable experiences sitting on your cushion. And if those experiences are sort of halfway there, what happens is they become special experiences, and you create this vertical hierarchy for yourself of special experiences and ordinary experiences, special people and deluded people. The joke is, I've had a great experience of oneness. Now I'm different from everybody else. See, that's the kind of experience of being halfway there, where you get blinded by the light of some special experience, rather than allow that light to show that everything is arranged on this hierarchical dimension of equal value. That's the true meaning of oneness. That everything is worth your attention. Everybody is worth your care and respect. Everybody, including yourself, is the expression of Buddha nature. Everybody, including yourself, is in this strange way perfect just as they are. And that kind of phrase sticks in the craw of a lot of people. What does it mean to be perfect as you are? It's got nothing to do with the content of perfect versus imperfect. But it's the perfection of just this, just this, just this. Where each moment is taken whole and fully. It's not existing in comparison to the moment before or the moment after. It's not being compared to an ideal moment or a bad moment you want to get rid of and replace with this good one. It's the perfection of being the only thing that's happening right now, just this, just this, just move. Just you. That's all there is. So opening Sesshin, I asked this not to compare what we're doing online today with the traditional Sesshins we may have attended in the past. But to take this experience as its own paradigm, as its own perfect example of how to do it this way. But we need to watch ourselves as we go through the day, because our mind will inevitably revert to thoughts of how is it going? How am I doing? Am I doing this well or badly? Just let those thoughts be there. They're just thoughts. They can come and go. But also, in the midst of that, ask yourself simply, what is it?